good afternoon to myself.
I see you over there.
In my cone of silence.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So, my name is Erin Ryan. I guess I might as well just confess that early on.
And I'm still Bill Cundiff, and what do we got going today?
Well, okay, so first, and I forgot the card. What the heck? I'm so discombobulated. You know, I'm just going to say it. I'm really excited that the campaign season is almost over, but I'm terrified that
that
the campaign season is almost over.
Yeah, I almost don't recognize her. I've only
just
seen
from
her,
lack
you know,
of
about 3 hours.
I was going to say for lack of exposure, but that makes it sound like there's something funky going on at our house. So let's see. We've got a campaign. If we're going to do local, let's just do local stuff here in Shasta County. We have a local GOP. ShastaGOP.com is your source of information. There is a voter guide there. There are directions to the headquarters, which are super simple. It's on the corner of Hempstead and East Cypress, right across from Lithia Chevrolet. Open Monday through Saturday from noon until 6. We have bunches of Trump gear.
Lithia Chevrolet is open Monday?
No, I don't know what they're doing, but the campaign headquarters is open.
Campaign. Oh, okay.
See, Bill doesn't get to work at the campaign headquarters because he gives people bad directions.
I'm easily confused.
you're fired again. Oh, wait, no, I'm lying. We always need volunteers. So, yeah, the campaign headquarters is open. So if you do not have a Trump sign, and I'm telling you, this is the year. I've got people who are worried, like, oh, I don't know if I want to put a sticker on my window of my car, and I'm not sure I want to wear a button. But I tell you, people are really, really looking right now for their people, right? It's very tribal this year.
Oh, yeah.
So if you are a Trump supporter, just come by, and it's $2.
You know,
get a little pin.
Put on a little Trump pin, and you're going to find out who's who at the zoo, because, boy, people do comment.
I got three of them out at the grocery store last night.
Yeah, people love them.
They're like, oh, I like your pin. I'm like, here, you want to wear it?
Yeah.
They do. They want to wear it.
They snap it right on.
Anyway, yeah, we started a little sign war in our neighborhood. It's not really a war. It's just sort of fun. We put up our Trump Vance little bunting and stabbed a few signs in the yard. And then the guy across the street put up Paris Waltz. And then two doors down, she put up a Trump flag and has a spotlight on it. And then the guy across the street from her went Harris Waltz. And the guy down the block from us puts a Trump sign out. So it's gotten kind of fun. Have a good time with it, but definitely.
And we got a flag. We got a Trump flag in the neighborhood now.
That just popped up, so we're ahead. Because, we're keeping score because that's how we are. And anybody who puts up something, we give them a pin and a bumper sticker. Here's your prize. Thank you for playing.
You're the free sucker.
So the stuff's really inexpensive. I've been finding stuff, and Brenda found a bunch of stuff. So we've got, Trump pins. They're a little small. They're little elephants, and they say Trump 2024. They're $2. Get a few of them. Stick one on your shirt and give them to other people and let people know that this is the year to vote early. As soon as you turn your ballot in, just remember it gets scanned back through the Registrar of Voters, regardless of where you live. It doesn't get counted, but it gets scanned back in. And your bigger campaigns that are burying you in mail and texting and phone calls will stop burying you in mail, texting, and phone calls.
And I know that works because I voted early, and a couple weeks later I got a campaign thing in the mail, so I went and voted again. And that time it took. I don't get them now.
You don't get to vote. I fill your ballot out.
Oh.
Bill has no idea what he's talking about.
What did I vote for?
Just for the record, I do not sign it. Here, sign this. But no, it's a good way to do it. It does stop the campaign mail. So if you have people complaining that they're getting deluged by campaign mail, tell them to turn in their ballot.
Vote often and vote early.
And don't wait till the last minute and then go, oh, it doesn't matter, and then throw it away.
Yeah,
for God's sake. There's a lot of stuff on the ballot. So if you live in Shasta County, go to ShastaGOP.com. We've got the propositions on there, lots of candidate information, and we can help you. And school board as well, actually, County Board of Schools. That's a county school board things. Those are big this year. We have endorsed some of those folks. So please go do your homework and turn your ballot in and tell your neighbors to put out a sign.
Yeah.
It's way more fun than you think. All right. Let's get with the program here. Literally the program. I'll just confess, I had a screw-up last week, and sorry about that. I thought Claire was on, and then I thought Dr. Chen was on, and I don't know, I got them all wrong. Got everybody on the wrong week. And unfortunately, Dr. Chen just called the studio while Claire was on. It's like, oh, God, it's still happening. I'm the worst. So Claire Lopez is really our guest today for sure. And I'm going to give you the short version, the fun version of her bio. It's all online at wethepeopleradio.us. But Claire received her BA in Communications and French from Notre Dame College of Ohio and an MA in International Relations from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. She completed Marine Corps Officer Candidate School in Quantico, Virginia, before she declined a military commission to join the CIA. And she's co-authored and published two books on Iran. She's the author of multiple book chapters, plus numerous articles on China and its civilian-military fusion biological weapons program. She's the author of The Rise of Iran Lobby and co-author and editor of CSP's Team B2 study. Maybe she'll tell us about that. Sharia, the Threat to America. So she's kind of in She is in the know about all this stuff. And we spoke with her a few weeks ago, actually. And the topic of the two-state solution with Israel and the Palestinians and all that came up. And that's I think that's kind of a fallback for a lot of people who don't know what's going on. Well, hey, why don't we just, the two-state solution, that'll be great. So we thought, let's have an expert come on and tell us how that may or may not work. I'm thinking may not, but we'll let Claire give us the 411 on that. Claire, it's all you.
Well, hello to both of you, Aaron and Bill. Good to be with you again and all of your listeners. Thanks for listening in. It's always great to talk with you all.
If you can figure out which week we're having you. We've never had that much trouble before. I don't know what happened. I've gone insane. It's campaign insanity. It stole my mind.
No worries. It got all straightened out.
Yeah.
All right. So where would you like to start with all this?
Well, for those listeners who might be of a Jewish or Christian persuasion, we can start with the Bible and the Tanakh, the Old Testament, as Christians would say, the Tanakh, as Jews would say, and the journey of Abraham, his wife Sarah, his son Isaac, to the Promised Land about, 3,500 years ago, moving from a place that today would be located in Iraq, maybe, a place then called Ur, on up to the Levant, we would say today, the shoreline around the shores, the southeastern littoral of the Mediterranean Sea, 3,500 years ago. And then, of course, comes Jacob, the son of Isaac, the 12 tribes from his 12 sons, and that was the Jewish people, the origins of the Jewish people in the Promised Land, in the Levant. And so that goes back 3,500 years ago. There's no way around it. The Jews, Israelites, maybe they were called at that time, been there, been on the land, promised land to them, a covenant between Abraham and Hashem. That goes back to biblical times. If people are familiar with their Bible, that's what it says. That's what is believed. And in fact, by archaeology and other studies done in the land of the Jewish people, it's very clear that the Jewish people's presence in that land goes back 3,500 years. As a matter of fact, the Jewish people are the only people on the face of the earth, actually, who have the same name, the same language, the same faith, and the same homeland for at least 3,000 plus years.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and they want to claim that they don't belong there.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other thing that's been done more recently, and this is thanks to modern science, are DNA or mitochondrial tests of Jewish people of ancestries that go back all these thousands of years. And as you may know, the mitochondria is traceable through the female line. As we all know, of course, Jewishness is passed along matrilineally, that is, from the mother. Children born of a Jewish mother are at least ethnically Jewish. So the tests were done on people who were Sephardim, Mizrahi, and Ashkenazi. The Mizrahi, of course, are those who descended from the Jewish people who never ever left the land throughout the many years of exiles and genocides and pogroms. They were there all of that time, and their descendants. The Sephardim are those Jewish people of the region around the Middle East, North Africa, and on up into the Iberian Peninsula, for example. And these were Jewish people who were displaced by exile and genocides, and especially after the Roman times when the Jewish people were scattered from their homeland. And finally, the Ashkenazi are those Jewish people and descendants who probably traveled the furthest away from the Jewish homeland. Again, pogroms and genocides and exiles. And these were people who settled throughout Europe, then Eastern Europe, and all the way east into what would today be Russia. And then, finally, after beginning, well, a long time ago, but at least by the 1800s and Theodor Herzl, the return to the land, the return to the Jewish homeland, the people were gathered in once again. And then by 1948, of course, the UN recognized, building on what the League of Nations before that had established the modern-day nation-state of Israel in the ancient homeland of the Jewish people.
That's
why do you think this is not? I mean, obviously, it's history, so the information's available. Why do you think it's so? It's suppressed everywhere. This isn't something that's ever discussed. And how? I mean, what did that take you? 6 minutes? Five minutes to lay that all out?
Well, there's more. Partly it's because history in general is not taught.
Yeah, that's true. It's kind of unpopular now.
I mean, go back and look at our own founding fathers and the ages, by the way, they were at the time of the founding of our republic. Take a Thomas Jefferson, for example, who was in his early 30s at the time he wrote the Declaration of Independence. And the other leaders were, some of them, in their 20s, some in their 30s. I guess the old man might have been Ben Franklin. I think he might have been in his 40s. But by the time these founding fathers of our own republic had gotten through what we would say today middle school or, you know, high school, they already had studied foreign languages, in particular Hebrew, Greek, certainly Latin, in addition to English. And yes, they knew how to speak English properly. But they had also studied philosophy. They had studied mathematics. They had studied history of the Western world, Western civilization to be sure, but also of the ancient worlds. Again, Greece, Rome. They were far better educated literally as teenagers, and this includes history, to your question, as teenagers, far better educated than probably our college graduates today. So it's a lack of teaching of history currently, and really for a long time here in the United States. So, you know, the students get passed along from grade to grade, whether they can read or not, whether they can do, you know, even basic arithmetic or not, and they finally get handed diplomas, and they're total ignoramuses. They don't know history. So that's a good part of it. But what you said there, Aaron, was another part of it, and that is the suppression of history, of the teaching of history, of real history. And I mean, modern, you know, technology has enabled the internet and social media and media of all kinds. And that enables information operations, propaganda, you know, all of the above, suppression of history, twisting of history. And then again, back to our schools, the failure, you know, to teach real history. So all of that contributes to it, I guess.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate because all these different, yeah, you see, I mean, you hear it too. I guess we'll get into all that later, but you know, all the Palestinian protest thing here in...
You mean pro-Hamas, don't you?
I was being nice. All of that. You look at that and you go, what are you thinking? Like, do you not...
Well, they're not thinking.
Yeah, there's
critical
that.
Critical thinking is unfortunately too often absent among today's students and professors. And here we have kind of a revolving door, don't we? So... the students come into these, well, formerly elite places of learning, Ivy League schools, for example. And, you know, these Ivy League schools have been funded for, again, decades, often to the tune of gazillions of dollars out of the Middle East, especially places like Qatar. That's home away from home for the Muslim Brotherhood. In the Gulf region, and Saudi Arabia, millions upon millions of dollars poured into these different universities. But with those dollars come strings. The strings attached include professors from those places. Mm-hmm. They include curricula from those places. They include Middle East studies departments, chairs, and programs from those places. So that all goes into the school curriculum. The students are put through all of that. They come out the other end with those diplomas in their hands, whether they actually earn them or not. And many of them go on the revolving door part here to become professors themselves, back into academia. Others go into government. They go into media. And other professions too, but an awful lot of them go back into academia themselves. So that's what I mean about the revolving door. And so then another generation of students in those places is indoctrinated instead of educated.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, you wind up with a kind of a closed information loop. All right, let's mull that over. We've got to take a really quick break. We're going to come back. Our guest is Claire Lopez, and discussing kind of the myth of that two-state solution. So we're going to set that up and deal with that. Claire is our hostage for the whole 2 hours since I finally got the week right. Oh, my gosh. You can find all of this, and you can send the archive later from We the People Radio.
.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over but good. They want you all body and soul, then it's just your body, then they go. What shall we do about them? Let me know you're here, 'cause my TV set just keeps it all from being clear.
guest is Claire Lopez, and I was going to give you another little blurb on her. So she served as a member of the Citizens Commission on Benghazi, continues as a member of the Citizens Commission on National Security. She was formerly the vice president of the Intelligence Summit. That's just a fun resume item. I would like to be the head of an intelligence summit for sure. She was a career operations officer with the CIA, professor at the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies, and executive director of the Iran Policy Committee. So just in case you were thinking this was all just Claire's opinion, she's got the cred to back it up. She's not just some person coming on to chit-chat about all of this.
She didn't just read it in the paper.
Yeah, mostly no.
So Claire, where does... Or when did Hamas come on the scene? I mean, it's like we have a pretty good background on the Jewish people and how long they've been there. What's the story with Hamas?
Well, for Hamas, which by the way is an acronym, which means it should always be spelled in caps, H-A-M-A-S, which is the acronym for the Arabic. Harakat al-Islamiyya, Mukawamiyya fi al-Iraqwa. I'm sorry, wait, let me start over again.
So it's not horrible,
Harakat,
awful maniacs. Okay, sorry.
Harakat Mukawama al-Mukawama al-Islamiyya, which means the Islamic resistance is what it means. So Hamas is the Gaza branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. So we really have to go back to the Muslim Brotherhood. Where did it come from? The Muslim Brotherhood was founded in 1928 by a group of students in Cairo, headed by Hassan al-Banna. And they formed the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan. You might hear it, see it written or hear it said, meaning brotherhood in Arabic. They formed it because 4 years prior to that, in 1924, at the conclusion of World War I, the Turkish Ottoman Empire, and we'll get back to this when we talk about the land that the Turkish Ottoman Empire once controlled throughout the Levant, but that land was lost to the Ottoman Empire, and Turkey was reduced to the country of Turkey as we know it today, with those boundaries. And a military man named Kemal Atatürk. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk is a nickname. It means father of the Turkish people. His name was Mustafa Kemal. He took over Turkey at the end of World War I, and he began to analyze why the Turks lost World War I. As we know, they were allied with the Germans. The Allied powers, of course, defeated them. Well, he began to analyze why did the Turkish Ottoman Empire lose. And he concluded, well, it's because they did not keep up in modernization of civic administration of the state, modernization in terms of military technology. And he and those who ran the Turkish government then in the early 1920s decided that they needed to catch up with the West in all kinds of areas, beginning with civic administration, but military technology and every other kind of technology, railroads and roads and everything else, too. But in terms of the civic administration, they decided that governments needed to be secular, whereas, as we know, of course, the Turkish Ottoman Empire was an Islamic caliphate, the last Islamic caliphate, we'll get to that in a minute, until the current day. But the government needed to be secular. And the people could be whatever they wanted to be, but the government would be governed in a secular way.
But the people could be whatever they want. Yeah,
the
doesn't
people
really sound like it would work.
Continue to be, you know, Muslim or you know, the Christians had already been mostly murdered in, of course, the 1915 and onwards Armenian genocide, which killed a lot more than just Armenians, Greeks, and many others as well. But hypothetically speaking, The government would be secular. The people would follow their own faith. And so what Kemal Ataturk did was abolish the last Islamic caliphate. Now, a caliphate had existed since the time of Muhammad, if he ever lived, which we're not sure of, but just let's say he did. And after his reported death in the year 632 AD, there was a disagreement about who should take his place. And the majority of his followers said it should be decided by a group. They come together, they talk about it, they decide who will be the leader. Those became the Sunnis. That is the majority of Muslims then and to this current day, probably 80 or more percent of the world's Muslims are Sunni. But the minority said, no, it should follow down the bloodline of the Prophet Muhammad himself, meaning through his daughter Fatima, who married her cousin, well, they all married their cousins, Ali, and their sons were Hassan and Hussein. Well, this all came to a head in the 680 Battle of Karbala. Karbala, a place today, we would say that's located in Iraq, southern Iraq. And the battle pitched the Sunnis, the Caliph, Muawiyah, the battle took place against the Shiite, the followers, the bloodline of Muhammad. Now we're down to his grandson, Hussein, and they lost. They were pretty much wiped out, except for, I guess, at least one male heir must have survived somewhere, because from then on, there was a succession of 12 father-son imams, and we can get to that, but those are the Shiites. The Sunnis won. Well, that led to, on the Sunni side, a sequence of caliphates. The Shiites had imamates, the Sunnis had caliphates. And from that point onwards, until the 1920s, 1924, there was always a caliphate. Maybe there were even two or three sometimes, and they fought each other. But there was never not a caliphate until Kemal Ataturk abolished the last one in 1924, trying to secularize the governance of what remained of Turkey. So that was a complete disaster for Muslims all over the world. They didn't have a caliphate for the first time in hundreds of years. And that is why, 4 years later, the Muslim Brotherhood was established by Hassan al-Banna and his fellow students in Cairo, Egypt. Well, fast forward from there, the Muslim Brotherhood spread. The military government, governments I should say, plural, because many times there have been military governments in Egypt, suppressed the Brotherhood because they recognized them as threats to their own power. They didn't believe anything different. They were all the same Muslims. Their ideology was Islamic as you know, the Quran. But the point was, in Egypt you get your choice, a military government or the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood spread out of Egypt because very often they were suppressed in Egypt and exiled and kicked out. That's where the Gaza branch of the Muslim Brotherhood came from, called Hamas. Now, the founder was a so-called Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Ahmed Yassin first established at least one other organization founded from the Muslim Brotherhood. But by the late 1970s or so, he lived in Gaza, by the way. He lived in Gaza. By the way, 80% of all Gazans are Egyptian by ancestry. Just fun fact there. Sheikh Yassin obviously had come to the attention of the government of Israel, obviously. This is the 1970s. We know that at the time that Yasser Arafat, the PLO, were running around creating chaos.
And they were Shiites, is that right?
Hamas were Shiites. I'm sorry, no. They were all Sunni. Take that back. They were all Sunnis.
Okay.
These are all Sunnis. Meaning Yasser Arafat, well, he was communist too. He got the help of the KGB, I guess, but Sunnis. The PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, Sunni Muslim Brotherhood, and its offshoots, all Sunni. Shiites, we can get to that later, but that's Iran.
Okay.
There was also an offshoot. There was a proxy jihadi organization established in Gaza by the Iranian regime called the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, PIJ, and they are Shiite, but smaller. But stick for the moment with Sheikh Yassin. He comes to the attention, of course, of the Israeli government. They go after him. He winds up spending a stint in jail, in Israeli jail. But they let him go, eventually released him. And because at the time the PLO and Yasser Arafat were causing such mayhem and chaos, remember the airplane hijackings and other attacks, 60s right. into the 70s, the government of Israel, in my opinion at least, made a serious blunder. And they decided to back Sheikh Yassin as a counterweight to the PLO and Yasser Arafat. And they actually did that. Big mistake. But fast forward through a bunch of history till the 1980s. And in the latter part of the 1980s, 1987, Hamas was formally established. That's when it was formally established. Its predecessor is everything I just told you. But it was established formally in 1987. The Hamas Covenant is published online. You can see it in English online on the Internet. Just look up Hamas Covenant. It's sometimes called a charter, but I always call it a covenant for the simple reason that, in my mind, a covenant is something established between men and God. A charter is between men and men. But this, Hamas's covenant, was between the founders of Hamas and Allah, which is simply Arabic word for God. And so I call it a covenant. But it's online. It's in English. And of note, in the first opening lines, it says this. It says, Israel exists and will continue to exist until Islam, not Hamas, until Islam will obliterate it as it has obliterated others before it, end quote.
Wow. That sounds like a recipe for peaceful coexistence right there.
And that's how they were able to take over the government leadership of Gaza?
Later. First comes the First Intifada, as you probably know, which broke out in 1988. That was the First Intifada. And that was, all over attacks against Israel, in which Hamas participated, but also out of Judea and Samaria, militias there, Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, and many others, out of townships like Jenin and Nablus and Tulkarm and all the rest. So that was the First Intifada, and Hamas was part of it. That really broke, any thought of collaboration between them and the Israeli government. Now, fast forward a bit more. In 1993, we had the Oslo Accords, which granted, inconceivably to me and many others, granted recognition, official recognition to the Palestinian Authority, which was basically comprised of the PLO and Yasser Arafat's other organization, which was established about 1958, the PLO in 64. That's what made up the Palestinian Authority. Granted recognition, and not only that, but they eventually won Nobel Peace Prizes. It blows my mind. But in any case, that's 1993. And as Yasser Arafat admitted openly in Arabic, but which maybe many people don't understand, but openly admitted that in Islam, a temporary cessation of jihad is called a hudna. We might translate it as ceasefire, but it's more like a temporary break in the fighting until the forces of Islam can regroup, rearm, and get themselves ready for the next phase of jihad. Well, That's what Yasser Arafat called the Oslo Accords, a hudna. Dates from the time of Muhammad, and that's all historical stuff, where that term and that policy come from. But I don't know why people didn't notice this or recognize this at the time, but he very openly said this is nothing more than a hudna. Well, so it was. Because by the end of the 1990s, come up to 2000, the year 2000 actually, was launched the Second Intifada. And that was the one with all the horrible suicide bombings on school buses and parlors and all of that. I've been to Israel multiple times, and on one of our trips, that was the theme of our trip, to visit all those places hit during the Second Intifada. The Park Hotel in Netanya, for example. Oh, we had the most graphic description of that suicide bombing, which took place in the hotel with a suicide bomber. But in any case, the Second Intifada, and again, Hamas was part of that, as well as attacks coming out of Judea and Samaria, same places as we said before. And after that...
Hold that thought, Claire, so we don't have to... I was looking for a good place to interrupt. There never is a good place.
Okay.
So just a really quick break. We're going to come back. Our guest is Claire Lopez. And you are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Good job, Bill.
Oh, thanks, sir. Stand your back, shift your arm, then you pull it back. Life's hard, you know. So strike a pose on a Cadillac. If you want to find all the cops, they're hanging out in the donut shop. They sing and dance. They spin the truck, booms down the block.
Okay, without interruption, cut right back in, Claire.
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. Carry on. We won't distract you from the... You were on a roll.
Okay, so, all right, we brought this up to the Second Intifada that broke out in 2000, lasted for several years, unfortunately. But... What next occurred was that the Israeli government, then under Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, decided, I guess, that Gaza was more trouble than it was worth. Or somehow that trading land for peace was a good idea. So in 2005, the Israeli government completely pulled out of Gaza. Not only the government pulled out, they uprooted every last Jewish person in Gaza and sometimes dragged them out of Gaza. They dragged everybody out of their synagogues. They even dug up the Jewish cemeteries and brought the bodies back for burial. So they were gone. Israel was out of Gaza by 2005. The next year, 2006, there were elections. The PA, Palestinian Authority, against Hamas. Well, in Gaza, Hamas won. And by the following year, 2007, they were throwing the remaining Palestinian Authority people off the tops of roofs in Gaza. So that was the end of the PA authority over Gaza or presence there at all. And the PA, of course... retreated, I guess you would say, to Judea and Samaria and rules out of Ramallah. But back there in Gaza now, at least from 05, you could say maybe from 07, okay, Gaza was essentially an independent, self-governing entity. The world showered Gaza through the United Nations, UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Works Agency, and in other nonprofits and charitable organizations and banks and you name it, absolutely showered Gaza with money.
Which was basically Hamas at that point.
Hamas was the governing authority in Gaza, elected by the people of Gaza. Well, you might know what a beautiful climate that part of the world has. If you've ever been to Israel, certainly it's the same in Gaza. Beautiful Mediterranean shoreline, a temperate climate where you can basically grow anything you want. Of course, Gaza shares all of that abundance with Israel, too. The other thing about Gaza people may not know is that one of the world's largest freshwater aquifers lies underneath Gaza. And all they need is pumps to bring the water up and distribute it throughout Gaza, to the people, to wherever, throughout Gaza. That needs electricity, yeah. And even now, post-2005, Israel was supplying Gaza with electricity. Also, providing workers from Gaza, like 20,000 a day or something, with jobs, construction, yard work, gardening, you name it, in and around the Gaza periphery, and further on into Israel. These workers came across the crossing checkpoints every single day and had jobs. And so you would think, you know, that this place could have been turned into, Singapore of the Middle East or something, right? It had every advantage.
Well, yeah, they had the money, they had the water, they had,
they had the beaches, they had the climate, they had agriculture. By the way, the Israelis left behind a large set of greenhouses. Which they, the Jewish people, had used to cultivate all kinds of, vegetables and fruits and herbs and whatever else. And the moment, back to 05, the moment that the Israelis had pulled out of Gaza, Hamas and the people of Gaza destroyed the greenhouses. They absolutely wrecked them. They tore them down. They obliterated them.
Because they were built by the Jewish people.
Yeah, that's why. That's why.
Wow.
Moreover, they did not use all that money flowing into Gaza to help the Gazan people or to improve their lives in any way. Schools, roads, all that, water, pumping, all of that. Electricity. No. What they did instead was turned all that money to building tunnels. I've been in one of them, crossing over from Gaza into Israel, which they intended to use and have used, tried to use, did use, to channel Hamas terrorists into Israeli communities and kibbutzim. And they also spent probably a lot of money on weapons, which were imported, many of them, from Iran. It's also its financial sponsor. Qatar was another financial sponsor. But a lot of the weapons, or the components to make the weapons, came in from Iran. And in particular, all that supply came across tunnels built under what's called the Philadelphia Corridor. This is an 7 kilometer long barrier or corridor that sits between the southern part of Gaza, that would be Rafah, the southernmost community of Gaza, and the Sinai Desert, meaning Egypt, right?
Right.
Which, by the way, of course, Israel returned back to Egypt after having conquered it in the 67 war. So
at this point, the people that were supplying the financial aid to Gaza knew where the money was going.
Oh, sure they did. Of course they did.
Yeah. Okay.
There's no way they didn't know. And so a lot of these tunnels, again, though, went from Egypt, that is the Sinai Peninsula of Egypt, across the Philadelphia corridor into southern Gaza. That's the most, I guess, used, the most important place that the weapons and ammunition and everything else came in, and particularly that was from Iran. Now, don't anybody even suggest that the government of Egypt, that is President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, didn't know about this. His family was making money hand over fist by charging smuggling fees to transport all of this from the Sinai, from Egypt, into Gaza.
Right.
They were complicit. They were completely complicit. Of course, now, as we know, Israel, in its military campaign in Gaza, has reached through to the bottom, the southern part of Gaza, and sealed off the Philadelphia corridor, which the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, really need to keep control over for the foreseeable future, so that those tunnels, which they have now discovered, and again, remember, I said about 8.7 kilometers, I think it's more or less that amounts to, I don't know, it's something like 10 or maybe 11 miles across. It's not very much. But there were like dozens and dozens and dozens of tunnels from the Sinai side into Gaza across there.
And I've seen pictures of those tunnels. It had to cost,
oh my gosh,
a fortune to build those tunnels.
Yeah, yeah. There were larger ones and smaller ones, but that is where the money went. While the people of Gaza, you know, suffered through poverty. I mean, they weren't taken care of. But nevertheless, let's remember, who are Hamas? They did not parachute in from Mars.
Right.
Hamas are the husbands, fathers, sons, and brothers of the Gazan people. That's who they are.
Right,
right. They make it kind of sound like it's an occupying army.
They're not, not at all.
All poor people
that
aren't involved.
And remember that on October 7th, the Shabbat massacre of 2023 last year, actually perhaps more Gazan civilians came across into Israel to rape, murder, pillage, loot, burn families alive, babies. More even than Hamas terrorists themselves.
Yeah.
Wow, and you don't hear that.
No.
You don't hear that at all.
It's pretty much out there. It's just a matter of time, and how much time do you have to actually, you know, spend looking at it all.
Right, but that isn't made clear, I guess.
A lot of, we're back to the information, aren't we?
Uh-huh.
And the media.
That's why I thought this was just really important, because this all gets dealt with in, you know, a minute and a half, and it's too complicated for that.
There's a lot to it. So the last thing I'll say about this, though, is that we were picking up from our last conversation some weeks ago about a two-state solution.
Right.
Now, I know you'll probably have to take another break again, and we can get back to what I consider the first possibility of a two-state solution, that being Jordan. Let's look at Gaza here. That was their second chance at a two-state solution.
Right.
It was governed. It was administered completely by Hamas from at least 2007, I would say from 2005, to October the 6th, 2023. They had the chance to turn that into really a very thriving enclave, but they did not, did they?
No.
They had that chance. That could have been a second chance.
Which is why we shouldn't fall for that again. We're going to come right back. Our guest is Claire Lopez, and you're listening to We the People Radio. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.